I would like you to help me welcome our next Al-Anon speaker. I heard her speak about 8 years ago here in Stanford at the convention. Don't ask me what I heard because I couldn't even tell you. I know that we sat in this in Marianne's living room and listened to the tape, and we maybe had to ask her to speak again. She's a wonderful person. I've had the pleasure of having a couple of meals with her, and she is just darling. So please help me welcome Beverly.
I'm Beverly Ross, and I'm a very excited, blessed, happy Al-Anon from Fort Worth, Texas. And as I was walking in, Mary Ann has been wonderful to me. Said, I can't go to church today, so you're going to have to be the God's prayer thing for me today. And I thought, oh, great. I'll make you just kind of weird, you know. But anyway, years ago I was speaking with Clancy in Canada, and I had thought I was supposed to speak on Sunday morning, and he kind of, you know, I don't know how many of y'all know Clancy, but he is not reticent, and he told me, he said, Beverly, they're going to ask you or me to speak on Sunday morning in Canada, you know, because I thought I was supposed to speak today. We're not a Sunday morning speaker, so, you know, anyway, I thought it was funny, and so it's a real joy to be asked up here again, to be a retread. You know, that's really exciting, and I was thrilled to death. I think it's funny, and I was thinking, oh, I didn't hear a thing she said. You know, I've been there. I've been out there when I didn't hear a thing they said, and then somebody, I think you were the one that said, you know, we only heard half a tape. And I said, half a tape? They just had half a tape. So I don't know whether I was here before they just said, oh, well, just give her half a tape. But there are a couple of people I want to thank. I don't know that he's back here. No, he's not. He's standing by the billboard. I want to thank Glenn for taping me. Because I know what it's like to tape, because my husband taped in Texas. And he died October 8th, and this is not going to be a sad story, but it means a lot to me to see you, Glenn, and thank you a lot. Anyway, I've loved all the speakers. I really enjoyed your talk. I thought it was so gentle and so sweet and so kind and such a tribute to Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank the committee for the flowers and all the stuff and all the telephone calls and everything. And I want to thank my sweet daughter-in-law who is here. And if you raise your hand, Cheryl Ross. She is married to my oldest son, who was the perfect child, you know. And he is the captain with American Airlines today. And so we had a wonderful trip up, and she's flight attendant, and I tell you, I can't even have Thanksgiving dinner without her because she's so efficient. And she got me here. They canceled my flight, and she went on the line at midnight and found out I could go an hour and a half early and got me on the early flight, which was packed. New York was blocked off. I don't know that you all know this, but boy, down in Texas, they were just canceling flights like mad, maybe three. So I was very lucky to get here when I did, and I give her that kind of credit. Anyway, everybody's been wonderful, and my husband always told me to start with my Al-Anon joke, so I will do that. I don't know if they tell Al-Anon jokes up here, what the alcoholics do. But in Texas, they tell a lot of Al-Anon jokes. And so I just have to tell you my Al-Anon joke, which is not really, I mean, the jokes they tell are things like, why does the Al-Anon keep her eyes closed when she's making love to the AA? Because she doesn't want to see anybody having any fun, you know. That's the kind of jokes they tell in Texas, you know, I don't know. I don't find them terribly funny. I never did that. I always had a headache, you know, or something. Anyway, my Al-Anon joke really happened to me, and that is that after we'd gotten into the program, my husband said to me, we're going to go to the Virgin Islands. And I went, the Virgin Islands? I mean, we had come in, you know, where the house was 3 months in arrears and all those kind of alcoholic things. But, yeah, we're going to the Virgin Islands. I wasn't going to ask. Oh, that's so nice. And he said, I can't get it. I've got our tickets, but I can't get our seats together. And you're going to sit one place. I'm going to sit another. Now, I believe that because I believed everything he told me till I got to Al-Anon. But the truth was he had had about all of me he wanted to have, and he had put me several rows up so he didn't have to sit with me. Because I thought, and I just have to stop and say, I just love Larcy. Wasn't she wonderful? Oh, my God. What a credit to Al-Anon. Oh. I have known Larcy for a long time, and I just love Butch. Oh, my gosh, I love Butch. I mean, he is so cute. Everybody loves Butch, and she was the one that said, you may have thought he was a pervert because he was looking at everyone's chest to find his... He was looking at everyone's chest to find the chest fairy is what he was doing. But anyway, and guys, I called him Mary and the Three C's. I mean, that Friday night was something. If you all were not here, you need to get the tape because they were great, great about the family disease. Everyone was wonderful, all the committee, everybody, you know. So I'll tell them Al-Anon joke. Okay, we're going to the Virgin Islands. I'm sitting four rows up. We're on a plane. I am reading a book. I mean, I am so comfortable. I am so happy. We are now a little AA Al-Anon couple. I mean, what could be more wonderful? We are recovered. I always love the past tense. We are recovered, you know. So, and we're crazy nuts. I mean, we were nuts. Ronnie had me four rows up. That shows you something of the way our relationship was. So I'm reading my little magazine. He is having a blast. Now I want to tell you, he was the cutest, most adorable, precious, darling thing that you ever saw. He was a huggy bear. He was darling, precious when he drank, particularly. He just drank and said, I love you, I love you, you know. Now the reason he loved me was I had the job, you know, and he always said that the definition of an alcoholic was he was to be married to someone who had a job. You know, that was very important. So I love you. Like, well, if you got an AA, it was, I don't love you, I don't hate you, I just don't have any feelings for you. I mean, honesty had returned our marriage. Anyway, so he's got me up there, and he's back there just loving all these people. And down the aisle came somebody like my darling Cheryl, and she is saying, only back then, the way I saw it was she was saying, coffee, Pierre, you want a drink? Coffee, Pierre, you want a drink? Now, I really don't think she was saying it like that, but that's the way I remember it. And, you know, coffee, tea was fine, but you want a drink was not, I mean, you don't ask an alcoholic with a year and a half if they want a drink, you know. But I didn't correct her. I let her go on by me. And when she got back to him, four rows back, I heard him say, oh, I don't want a drink. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am sitting there thinking, what happened to anonymity? You know, and I'm giving in this dirty list. And these people said, oh, you're an A. She went, oh, you're an AA? How did that happen? There was somebody around him. And with that, he started telling his entire story of how he got to AA. People ahead of him literally undid their seatbelts. They leaned back to have a conversation with him, asking pertinent questions. And I mean, he was off and going. I mean, if he got a microphone, he would have been. And people in the back of the plane are saying, back there with the drugs, fire the drugs. They're saying, the people in the middle are saying, there's an alcoholic in the front of the plane. You know? Oh, my God. It was not my moment of joy. You know, it was like, and I am sitting up there looking in the magazine. I'm the only one not into the, you know, to the thing. And suddenly he gets through the thing. He says, but if you really want to hear how it really was, that's my wife, Beverly. Four rows up there, and, you know, and I kind of did that thing. Queen for a day, right? We got down to the Virgin Islands, and there was a man sitting next to him who had been an attorney. And he saw me, and he came over, and I was on the beach, just wonderful, had my magazine. He said, in this, what I felt very loud was, are you the Beverly that was married to the alcoholic in the plane? And, you know, people on the beach are turning down looking, you know. and I said, yes, you know, and I said, and he said, well, tell me your story. And I said, well, I really don't have very much story, really. And I came to Al-Anon. And he went, Al-Anon? You couldn't come to Al-Anon. And I said, certainly I came to Al-Anon. I came to Al-Anon for the friends and families of alcoholics. And he went, my God, he said, I have been an assistant district attorney. We have sent people to jail for alcoholism. We have sent them to Alcoholics Anonymous for their alcoholism. And until this moment, I thought Al-Anon was the pill they gave AA to keep them sober. True story. And of course, I was a pill, but I didn't keep him sober. I mean, I tried. Anyway, I always carry my gratitude list in this, and I'd made a few notes, like Paige. Paige, don't have my glasses, and I can't read any of them, so I'm sure you'll be very pleased. But usually Buddy comes with me, and a lot of times he didn't come to Connecticut when I was here before, but I usually stop about halfway through and say, have I forgotten anything? And so Glenn only had half a tape. I couldn't say to him, have I forgotten anything? But obviously God's in charge. But anyway, that was my Al-Anon joke. I grew up in Fort Worth, Texas. I was born there. I always say, Buddy used to say, we were born, reared, wedded, and bedded in two blocks. And I was introduced in California one time, and I love California a whole lot because of people like Larsine that are really good friends of mine. But I was introduced in California as the only speaker they've ever had that had lived in the same zip code all of her life. So everybody has to have something, and I've always lived in the same zip code. But anyway, my father was, I start like that cute little Barbie, and it was hilarious. When I was 5, and now I'm 10, you know. Well, actually, I was born into a family that, I was a depression baby. And my dad was head of an oil company, and it wasn't that we were so rich, but the country was very poor, you know, in the depression. And I was with, my maiden name was Jaeger, Y-A-G-E-R, and which is German, and I had a German shepherd dog, and I had a German name, and I had a German nurse. And we had that kind of household, all the bills. I never heard money mentioned. I used to say my talk dealt with sex, God, and money, and not necessarily the order of importance. But there was money. There was sex later. and thank goodness later. And God was in the household from the extent that I was, you know, we did go to church, and I went to Sunday school, and that sort of thing. But He was more of a just umbrella, kind, loving, wonderful God. But it was not a, oh my goodness, anyone lose an earring? Anyway, nice gold earring. That's my gift, I bet. I hope it's gold. Anyway. So I grew up in this household, and I created, when I was a little girl, a playmate that I called Duda. I knew how to move into fantasy. I created Duda. I thought she was, as I look at it now, I knew she wasn't, but she was very real to me. And I used to think that was just terrible. And when I got to Al-Anon, a very sweet lady said, Beverly, you were lonely. And that's the way God lets you create that playmate to play with. But Duda was wonderful. If you have not had an invisible playmate, they mind. They play all the games you want to, you know. And I think when I married Buddy, if he had been like Duda, we would have not been up here, you know, because I knew everything. And I always feel like I was born talking. And I know I was born reading because I don't ever remember not being able to read. That nurse or somebody taught me to read when I was about 2. And I talked nonstop. My deal was if I can start talking, I can wear you out until you just give up. You know, you will just give up and let me have my way. That was the way I was before I got to you. Hopefully, I've been relieved of some of that. I had a great household. I mean, they were nice. I was disciplined. I never was thanked, but our anything like that. But I had to follow the rules, and I was a good little girl, and I followed the rules. And I had wonderful mother and daddy, I feel like. And I look at that. I've done a lot of fourth and fifth steps on my parents and on my background and on lots of stuff, which has given me a lot of clarity. But I got the blessing in that family, which we talk about in Texas. The blessing is that if you're born into a family where they think you're a good kid and they believe in you and they want the best for you, you get the blessing. Now, the joy is that no matter how wonderful that family is, you don't get that blessing unconditionally. I mean, you just, I don't think. I've never met anybody that was not a single condition on anything. But when you get to the program and you walk into the rooms of Al-Anon or Alcoholics Anonymous, you're given the blessing. Because we love you regardless. We may not like all of you, you know, that's in our opening, but we will love you. And I absolutely have to say, in the 24 years I have been in Al-Anon, these are the most wonderful, gentle, thoughtful decorations. And they said that Mary Ed made them, and I did want to, I don't know if she's here. Is she here? I don't know. Where are you, Mary Ed? Wow, you did a wonderful job. And I understand that she had pneumonia at that time and cut all these little things out. But I just think the circle of hope is the most precious. I think of every place I've ever spoken that has touched me more than anything, certainly with my husband's death. It has just been a real gift to me, Mary Ed, and thank you very much. Anyway, well, you said she deserves a lot of applause because they are wonderful. They're not gaudy. You know, I've been places she can't even see over. You know, like, I'm the speaker, I'm here, you know. Anyway, great taste. Anyway, when I was about 12 years old, or 12 or 13, I suddenly realized there was a subject out there I didn't know a thing about, and it was sex. I remember one time Al-Anon named Vernoy spoke with me down in Louisiana, and she said, Beverly's the only person I know that didn't know anything about sex till she was 12 years old. You know, where are the little boys? Didn't they take you out and kind of teach you? Well, I don't know. I must have been the kind of girl little boys didn't take out and teach about sex. But anyway, I really didn't know very much about it. But my deal always was, you know, up here, the intellectual deal. And so I realized this. God forbid I ask anybody about it. I'm sure my mother and daddy were way too old to know about anything like what was being whispered around. So I went to the public library, which is my best friend, and was till I got to Al-Anon. I go to the public library, I'm 12 years old, had little gold rimmed glasses, a brace on every tooth, and I was about this tall, and I weighed about 75 or 80 pounds. And I look up at the librarian, where I am every Saturday getting my little pile of books, and I said, I'm Beverly Ralston, Beverly Yeager, and I want all your books on sex. And she looked down and went, we don't give little girls books on sex. You know, I mean, just terrible, you know, furious. I was a terrible person. And you know how we do if we're in the pre-Al-Anon thing. It was okay, because I was going to get them. I mean, if I'd had to steal them, I would have gotten them. But, you know, but I thought to myself, aha, I'm going off to camp this summer. And I'm going to Wisconsin for 8 weeks to Naugatuck at this girls' camp, and I'd been to the camp since I was 10, so I knew the layout, and I knew there were older women there, like 13 and 14-year-old women, and that they could tell me all about sex. So I got a big notebook, and I tied a pencil on it, had 240 pages, I know, because it said on the front of the file notebook, and I put my name on it, and I put sex right after it. Telephone number, address. Got on that train, and the first day they started, and back then they started telling jokes. And so I whipped my book out, and they told the joke, and I wrote it down, and it was something about the farmer's daughter and the traveling salesman. And I wrote it all down, and of course they're kind of looking over at me like, how weird, you know, I have my little glasses on, and I'm writing away. Nerd is probably the word you're thinking of. I'm writing it down. And so they get to the verbs, and the first verb was the F verb, and I go, how do you spell that? And they spelled it, and I put it down, so I had a vocabulary list, and I said, now what is that? And they told me, and I went, ooh, I wrote all that down. And the next one was S-C-R-E-W, and I said, what's that? And they told me, and I said, same as above, you know, and I was so I had this textbook, and it was 240 pages long, and I didn't have time to study it, but all summer long, I put that every time anybody tell a joke, there I was, you know, I wondered if they didn't drown me in the lagoon. And here she comes with her book. And I figured when I got home, I'd study that book, and I'd know everything about sex I'd ever need to know. And so in the big deal, I wouldn't have to ask anybody. See, I wouldn't have to ask you, because then that makes me less than. It's real important for me to know more than you do. Real important, and that has stayed with me. I became an intellectual snob with very little reason to be there. A legend in my own mind, you know, as they say. But anyway, I copy everything down. I go home. I come home on the Santa Fe Chief. Mother is there to meet me. I jump off the train. And as it is tugging away, I realize I have left my book on the train. Beverly Yeager, 3801 Potomac. Sex. Vocabulary. I figure whoever got that must have laughed till they sobbed. Well, I learned to answer the phone immediately for about 2 months. Yeah. And I would have appreciated just heavy breathing. What I was interested in didn't want was, is there a Beverly Yeager there? Oh, my parents would have died. You know, what we don't know about our children. You know, I'm so grateful. That's the God of my understanding. He doesn't let me know everything about my children, because I didn't want my mother and daddy to know that, I'll tell you. Anyway, the next year I was to see the man that I loved every moment of my life, and still do. And he was the cutest thing I ever laid my eyes on. Oh, he was adorable. I went to an Al-Anon. No, it was an open AA meeting about a month or so before he died, and he was there, and he told this egregious story, just like when you get in the hot tub. We have a little pool. I won't call it hot tub. It's an in-ground pool, but it has the hot tub. And we have 9-foot brick fences, and it's around it, and it's very private, and we went in every night without our clothes. Well, I didn't tell anybody this. He told everybody this. I mean, everybody this. And would end it with, and if you want to know, they float. And this AA woman I just loved, who was at the thing, said, you know, years ago I was told, she was also an Al-Anon, she spoke right after Buddy did, and I was sitting there just paralyzed, you know, I'm dying, and this girl said, it reminds me, when you marry an alcoholic, it's like going to a theme park, and you can buy an A ticket and just ride the merry-go-round. You know, it just goes around. Doesn't even go up and down. You might get a B ticket and you get those little things that kind of move. You get the C ticket and you're on the roller and you're doing this. Boy, you buy the B ticket and you go up in the roller and down and you're in the missile chaser. And when you marry an alcoholic, you just bought the B ticket, and Beverly has just bought the B ticket, and that's the way it is. You know, and the thing that is so wonderful about alcoholics, and I just love them to death, they're so much fun. You know, they're so excited. Well, you know, Larson was explaining, you know, that thing. I mean, they just, I think that we want to go to the edge of the envelope, but we're too perfect. I thought in our own mind to do that. Too shy, too. But we're drawn to that. You know, we're drawn to that. And so, anyway, this man, Buddy, he was in Kemper Military School. He was a freshman in college. I had never had a date. I had not been through puberty. I was a late bloomer. Anyway, I had no chest, you know, anything. And I took one look at him and fell madly in love with him. And I can't know it doesn't happen that way with everybody, but it happened that way with me. And I looked at him, and when I see my 13 and 14-year-old granddaughter and think they might look around and figure out who they're going to be married to all the rest of their life, it's real scary. But I think God was in that because he was the perfect mate for me. He really, truly was. And he had a fabulous personality. He was adorable. I had heard about him a long time. He was a freshman in college. I had just entered high school. Now, I never dated. You know, just learned about sex, left the book on the train. You know, that's where I am. And he was so cute, you know, and he had a little military school uniform on, and the little wingy guy that I walked to the, the little wingy guy, so I was like, well, the little wingy guy that thought we were had a little relationship, so I took this look at Ray Ross, which was walk to the movie, you know, that kind of thing. We didn't date, we just kind of went with a little group. But anyway, the little wingy guy had been off camp with Buddy, and Buddy was a major or a colonel or something, you know, and whatever this, and he talked about Major Ross all the time. So I'd had it built up to me to start with, and then he was so cute. But I have to say that the wonderful thing about him is he had a yellow Chrysler convertible with plaid upholstery and white sidewall tires, and that was a big part of it. I mean, the little weenie guy drove his mother's car later. You know, I mean, this guy, I mean, he had it all together, you know. It looked like he did in many, many ways. But anyway, so I just thought he was adorable. And I don't know if anybody has been this weekend trolling or, you know, whatever. But I will tell you how I got him. And it may be of use to you in some future time. It worked perfectly. And that is, every time he would come anywhere in my kin or in my relationship, I would go, and I didn't do it on purpose. It was all from here. Oh, thank you, and I was saying to you, oh, my God, it's terrible. Oh, my God. Well, you notice people that talk about you like that. I mean, you know, and finally he said to somebody, who is she? I mean, I was this fan club, this chair. I had somebody behind me or with me, but I was leading this parade, and, you know. So he asked, I grew up with 8 boys in my neighborhood. I absolutely adore men. I love guys. Oh, my gosh, I love guys. There was a guy sitting next to me last night at the table. I don't know who it was. It wasn't you. You were across from me. You were really quiet. You were really quiet. But anyway, who was the guy next to me? No. Is he not here? Where are you? Stand up! Stand up! He's so cute! God in his infinite wisdom gave me 3 sons and 1 daughter, and my mother used to say, you're the best boy's mother I've ever seen. And the conversation ended. It wasn't, and you're the most wonderful girl's mother. I mean, the boys were perfect, you know. But anyway, I love guys. And these guys I grew up with, these 8 guys I grew up with, loved me a lot. And they were wonderful. And they didn't teach me anything about sex. I mean, I was just their little queen. I fixed them up. I was like a yenta or whatever that thing was. I fixed all the dates up for them. I got them, you know. And then they fixed me up. That was our relationship. Well, Buddy's best friend, who was younger, who lived across the golf course from me, was a guy named Tommy Mason. And he went to, when I was doing this, you know, he went to him and he said, he was the one, he said, who is she? And he'd been one of my best friends since I was born. And he said, oh, she's great, she's adorable, she'd rather swim than sunbathe. She's just a great guy, you know, you're just going to love her. You know, I kind of look like a guy, I didn't have any foot, you know, and I was. And so, anyway, for whatever reason, when he came home from military school, that was in the winter, when he came home from military school in the spring, in May, he asked me out for a date. Now, I do have a watch. Uh-huh. And I hope it works. It'll make you feel better if I keep doing this. Whether it works or not. Now, I told you I didn't have my glasses, but it looks very responsible for me to look at the time. So anyway, he asked me out for it. We were at a dance and I saw him. And he tagged in on me. And I mean, I just felt madly in love with him. Madly in heat. Madly in everything. I mean, it's just, oh my God, it was the most wonderful thing I'd ever seen in my life. And, but my parents, in their great wisdom, did send me off to camp every summer. So I was leaving in another day. So he came down. He came down to the train and saw me off, and I got on, you know, waved to my mother and everybody, and off I went. That summer was an amazing summer because I went off to camp. They heard the half a tape, imagine their husband's here. Anyway, I went off to camp, and I didn't have a bra. I didn't need a bra. You know, it was a foreign world to me to need a bra. And I would lie there on my bunk and watch them grow. Now, We had to have rest period. Everybody else is resting. I am watching them grow. And at first I was really excited. Now, I think they were growing along, but in my household we didn't watch ourselves grow. And so this is the first time I must have been growing before I got there. That's the only thing but anyway, I'm glad I didn't watch them grow. And then I got real nervous they weren't going to stop. And so I was real active at that time. I was a big swimmer, I had a lot of wet t-shirts, you know. And the counselors, which time I remember this happening, took me to Milwaukee and bought me a bra because I was already up like at least a D cup by the time they got me there. And, you know, it was like a, you know, 32D or so. I was a skinny little thing. But suddenly I was a skinny little thing with this huge front, this big front. I met somebody at breakfast and we were talking. I said, I'm wearing this because I'm changing clothes because I don't want to spill anything in my front. She said, oh, you have a shelf too. Anyway, so I go off, my shelf is growing, they put me in a bra. Now I can't walk really well because, you know, I'm top heavy. I'm going like this. I weigh about 98 pounds and it's all here. And now they're sticking straight out. And this summer, the Lord touched me. I was not only blessed by the chest fairy, but I joined the Episcopal Church. And so I got a kind of a double whammy. And I go down to the bookstore, which is on the campus, and I buy a huge cross that went nipple to nipple. Because now I am swinging along with my cross. Not only do I know everything about sex, but I'm a Christian. You know, I'm a Christian with a cross. Do you wonder why Clancy said you will never be asked to leave the Oh my gosh. Anyway, I come home, Mother's bought me a little pair of high heels, you know, about this tall. But so I'm practicing. I bought a real tight sweater because I know I'm going home to see him. And I have left one way and I'm coming home, darling, in a totally different woman. And I tell you, when you get that kind of chest, you don't need to know anything about sex. You can just turn sideways and they think you know everything. And so, to hell with the book. So I step off the plane, and Betty is there with my mother. Now my mother took one look at me and went, oh my God, grabbed the Kleenex, you know, she knew we were in big trouble. And Betty took one look at me and went, oh my God, you know, and I knew I had him. Half a tape, man. Which app did you hear? Must have heard that app because I saw people messing. Anyway, so we started the D-ride, and he was became a lieutenant in World War II, and it scares me today that I've had 19-year-old grandsons to know that he was a 19-year-old head of a B-17 bomber pilot. I'm telling you, those older guys must have really gone off the war to put those people, you know, out of those planes. But anyway, he's very responsible. He's a very good pilot. He usually graduated at the top of his class, so he was an instructor. People come up afterwards and say, what theater did he fly? And usually their people are very decorated and, you know, or they're widows or something. Well, he flew in the Gulf. You know, he said, I was a devout coward, and he was scared to death to be assigned, you know. But he was training in B-29s to bomb Japan when the war was over. But anyway, he always loved planes, and one of the great joys of his life is that his oldest son is a captain with American Airlines, and that was a great joy to my husband. Anyway, so we started that day ride, and we had four wonderful children. It was quite a ways into Al-Anon till I felt the gratitude. My gratitude list is that I had four healthy, wonderful children. I just thought everybody had healthy children. I didn't know anybody that didn't have healthy children. I don't know. My world was very encapsulated when I said I lived in this little block, so many block area. I did not have a single friend. And you know, Blanche, I don't know if any of you all know Blanche. Anybody in here ever knew Blanche? Oh, God, she died this year, you know. Boy, we hated to lose her in Texas. She wrote the blueprint for progress. And she was an incredible Al-Anon and a great mentor of mine in the state of Texas. The year after, when I was the state Al-Anon chairman for a while, and she followed me, and I went down and stayed a week. Not followed me like in my footsteps. She had been a delegate and done all sorts of things. But she wanted to know how to do that, and did I think she could do it with everything else she was doing. So I went and stayed with her, and Blanche was responsible for a lot of my program. But anyway, we started out, we had these wonderful children, three boys and a girl. Actually, we planned to have two children. And I was very organized about everything. And so I said, I would like to get pregnant to my husband. And this is the way we talk. I would like to get pregnant, and I want to get pregnant at the Waldorf Astoria. So we were going that summer, and we had it on business. We had a reservation. I said, I just think we need to get pregnant. I want a little girl, a little boy, and I want to get pregnant at the Waldorf Astoria. Now, we're going to be there 4 or 5 days. So I was very careful what I used right up until 4 or 5 days. Then we go to the Waldorf, and we have a good time. Then I'm careful again. And sure enough, I got pregnant. We had this beautiful baby boy, the one that the captain was American. And, you know, so 2 years later, I said, I'm like in 3 years apart, I want a little girl, and I want to get pregnant the night of the Rubato, which is a dance. So, same thing, got pregnant that night, and had a little girl. Now, I want to tell you, God has a huge sense of humor, because about 4 or 5 years later, I'm suddenly sitting up in bed saying, tell me I can't be pregnant! Tell me I can't be pregnant! And Buddy was like, you could be pregnant. No big deal to him. I mean, just my right eye love you. And then 7 years later, I am working now. Tell me I can't be pregnant. So we had 2 more that we always say we planned the first 2 and God gave us the second 2, and they have all been huge gifts to us. I guess I better just say right here because I don't want to forget the children. We have the captain, and quite often I talk about my children, and they come up later, not from the podium, and they walk over to me and say, I'm so sorry you didn't have more children, you know, because I get so carried away. And he went to the South Pole, and oh, he went over with the Russians and Japanese by the time he was 19, you know. And so he's real quiet. He's kind of like paint on the wall. Don't embarrass me has been his M.O., you know. Don't get on the plane and say, my friend's a captain with American Airlines, you know. So anyway, then we had our little girl, and I adore Rennie. She is head of the Chamber of Commerce in Ouray, Colorado, and it's just, you know, if I had 19 children, had to have 19, I'd want all boys because I love guys so much. But if I could just have one, I think I'd want a little girl because you just bond with your little girls and you just can buy the same kinds of clothes and do all that, and she is very close to my heart. Then the next child, the one that God gave us, is named Chuck, and he was an underwater diver and photographer. He did some work with Cousteau. He was a producer for the Discovery Channel, and it makes him sound wonderful. He got every wonderful characteristic Buddy and I have, and the worst characteristics we have. And he was the one that brought Buddy Ross to Al-Anon on his knees 14 years ago. And my husband attended AA every day. He went to 3 Al-Anon meetings, committed every week. And he always said Al-Anon saved his life. That it was like he'd filled in a blackout bingo and there was just a couple of things in there. He is responsible for the fact that we have about 1/3 or more men in our Al-Anon group. And they are a very strong part of our recovery group. Anyway, and I have 9 grandchildren, and they're absolutely precious and adorable. And one of them said to me, after Betty died, I was taking her after the mall, and there was a little, I had a little infinity, and it has a little thing, you know, where you pull the glass and look out. that's more modern than the cars I've ever had. Of course, it was a big deal to me. And so I went, oh, Lacey, there's a B-17 like your grandfather flew. And she looked up and she went, that's the way God got shot down. You know, they're just so funny and so precious and so darling, and I could spend the whole time talking about my darling grandchildren, but I won't. Anyway, so we started our band, the war, whatever, you know, and he was sweet as he could be. He just drank a lot, and my deal was he didn't understand how to drink, and I sat out on his teaching career, of which I was a teacher, surprise, surprise. That was what I did. That was my daytime job. And my nighttime job was teaching him how to drink. And he would say he didn't know how to drink, and I would get a bar. I bought a bar with a top and a little thing that played, little cocktail shaker. I took a course on how to make hors d'oeuvres. I bought Mr. Boston's Guide to, I think it now I say alcoholism, but I think it was Mr. Boston's Guide to Drinks or something. And I was so rigid, we drank the drink that was on the page number, because I couldn't remember it. You know, like, today is what, the 25th? We would drink the drink on page 25. I would make that drink, and he had to drink it, because I was teaching him how to drink. And I would tell him, you have a drink, and then if you have another drink, it makes you feel funny. You don't have another drink. And he'd say, yes, you know. And later he said, that feeling funny is what he likes. I mean, that's the feeling he wanted, you know. But anyway, basically we had, I'll tell you two quick stories. One was that, in this period, we just were crazy. We had cats, and we had a cat door, a rather large cat door. It was about like this. And, one Thanksgiving, I'm going to have the perfect Thanksgiving. I don't know if you all are like that, but we're going to have the perfect Thanksgiving. I had all the family coming. We were out at the lake. I was going to have it at home. We'd been out at the lake vacationing over for just a little Thanksgiving thing. And so I jumped up at 4 o'clock in the morning, drove in town, jumped out of my car because get the turkey supposed to get everything on so that when everybody came, it would just be perfect. No, I didn't ask anybody for help, and I had the ivy twined down out of the chandelier to the placemats, you know, that kind of thing. Everything was going to be wonderful. And so I jumped out of the car and realized I do not have my purse. It is pitch black. My neighbors are out of town. There's nobody at my house. I am sitting there panicked, and I'm circling the house, you know, like the wolves in Russia looking for raw meat. And I'm frantic, and I look at these trees, and I think I can climb this tree and get up on the deck, and I'm scared I'll break my leg. And then I happen to see the cat door. And I thought, you know, I can get my front, which you can move around, into the thing, and I can reach my hand up, and now the cat door, of course, is down for cat flip. And I can, and in full, we have a carport, which looks out on this park, so I get down on my hands and knees, and I get my front in, and I get my arm up to throw the lock, and I'm trying to throw it, and I pull real hard, and I stick at my hip. And I am stuck in the cat door. I am stuck in the cat door from around 4:30 or 5 in the morning till around 9. And I am saying, Chuck! Chuck! Because Chuck was supposed to have spent the night at home. And, of course, knowing Chuck, he didn't probably, might not have spent the night, but all I can think of is maybe he had spent the night. So I'm going, Chuck! Chuck! And my little head is in, my bottom is out. He comes down. This is the Allerton story, if any of them are here. He comes down. Now, he knows, he adores his dad. He knows his dad. He knows his dad a long time. But he has got, as Larson said, the craziest mother in the whole world. And I mean, he's had to go to school where I'm teaching. That's a joy. And so, it's kind of like attending with Hitler's wife, you know. And so, he comes down the stairs, he takes one look at me and goes, oh my God, how many of my friends have given down to you? You know, just, and I went, Chuck, it is not my eyes that are in the carport. I do not know how many of your friends have given down. Get me out of the damn car, you know. So he pulls me out laughing, which is not, you know, salt in my wound. And so anyway, I had high school. And they were all really glad I'd gotten an Al-Anon, I'll tell you. But anyway, so I'm telling this story about the cat to my senior, I thought it, bank placement senior
English, and I was head of the English department, and so I said, was telling the story about the cats, and Elizabeth, who was on the front row, raised her hand and said, "Oh, Mrs. Ross, you must have had huge cats." Many a student came by to see the cat door. They just could not envision, because I have lost weight since my husband died. I was not as tiny in life as I am today, shelf and all. But anyway, so that's the cat door story. And the other story is that the Christmas before we got to the Buddy Got the program, I was going to have the perfect Christmas. It always starts like a fairy tale. I was going to have the perfect. I was going to have the perfect Thanksgiving. Now I'm really going to have the perfect Christmas. We have been drinking for 27 years. I am not a happy camper here. And I am keeping everything together. I am earning all the money. I am blah, 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 me, 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 me. But now my husband is not an alcoholic. You have to understand that. He is not an alcoholic. He just does not understand how not to drink too much. He has a lot of problems. A lot of problems. A lot of particularly problems with jobs. And if you had that kind of problems, you'd drink too, you know. And so, you know. So I'm still having the drinking lessons, you know, and everything going on. So we're going to have the perfect Christmas. I bought this beautiful white clock tree. I had every ball tied with the cat. I'm so grateful Al-Anon delivered me from this kind of perfectionism. Every ball was tied with a ribbon that matched every package that was wrapped under the tree. And no child could come near the tree. You were not to approach. If I could have put an alarm on like those cars have, "You have come too close to the car," I would have had, "You have come too close to the tree." You know. So, we're going to have the perfect Christmas. I had Siamese cats. They matched the tree, I saw. So, I wanted to have little red cat collars that matched the ribbon, and I had put holly on every ribbon and on every ball, so I was going to tie holly. I put holly. Now, I had Simon's cats, if you're at all interested in cats. And I love them. I love my cats. Anyway, they were going to wear holly, and they were going to match the balls, and they were going to sit by the tree, not the children, because they did not match the tree at all. I don't even remember what they had on. Old hand-me-downs from somebody, I'm sure. And Hatchet Mary had it all planned. Well, Buddy, I go down to the pet store to buy the red deals, the little red deals. I bought the holly to put on it. And I do not remember this, but I babbled all the time at this time. And I entertained him all the time because that kept him awake. I'd write things on my hands, you know, I'd go from hand to hand and up my arm to entertain him, to keep him awake. And so I am telling him about these cat collars, and that I've gone down to the pet store, and I've seen this cute little, I remember saying something about a little dog that was real adorable, but I evidently saw these Japanese hooded rats, which are black to the waist, white to the tail. Oh, yeah, Japanese hooded rats. I think, or sounds like a cute little friend, should have been the other way. Whatever, white to the waist, black to the tail. I've never had a rodent, I've never had a gerbil or whatever you call those things. I don't like things without hair on their tails. I mean, they just, ooh. Well, anyway, these are things. I do remember standing up in a box and people saying, "Oh, this is gentle, this is sweet." And I just kind of said, "And they had these Japanese." Well, anyway, that's all he heard. He had very selective hearing. He was, you know, really very selective. And so he hears this, and he used to say that he always had to get a lot of stuff to piled up so that when I'd get mad, he could say, "Well, now, you know, I did give you so-and-so." So he brought home Christmas Eve these Japanese hooded rats in a bird cage. And our Siamese cats thought, you know, their dinner, I mean, they had arrived, their Christmas present. The children went crazy because I didn't let them have little alternate pets. And they went, "Hey, rats!" You know, we had to put them up on top of the bookcase. They immediately started copulating, I guess. That is sitting in a moment of how I could get through it. Anyway, immediately, the children just thought that was wonderful. And so, and I'm trying to act like it isn't happening, you know, and I am the rhinoceros. They want me a coffee table. And so I'm having this happy Christmas, and we're playing all these songs, and they're not to look at the rats copulating up there. and I will tell you, if you don't know anything about biology with rats, every 27 days they have a litter for boys, for girls. I know this is going to be interesting. This is what you come for. And in no time at all, we had, they said, because we had three bedrooms upstairs that connected, kind of, and they had bought habit trails with those little yellow tubes and little exercise rings that we could have healthy rats. And they exercised, and they copulated, and they did all that until we had, they said, you couldn't have counted them, but they said we had, because they were dying, they were running. I mean, how can you count for three bedrooms with those yellow tubes and exercise rings? 180-something rats. Now, remember, I had Vita when I was growing up. We didn't have rats upstairs. I didn't even know what you were talking about. And God forbid they ever bring one downstairs or act like we really have rats. But I am buying rat food, 50 pounds of rat food. They are having daily funerals out in the backyard because they do die. We had a few rat breakouts when the Siamese cats would get up the stairs. They were locked out up there for that day. And knocked the tube over, and then they'd scream, "Rat breakout!" I would go out to the patio and act like I didn't know what they were talking about. So, this is the last story. But anyway, so oh my gosh, my husband's roommate came up from Austin to visit, to go to the Kimball Museum, which is a big art center there, and brought his daughter, and this little girl was 11 or 12, and so I'm having a cocktail party, because I have learned to make these little hors d'oeuvres, where you can, little chickens will do their little, I can pull a little string, I mean, I had these little hors d'oeuvres, and I had a page 27 of the book, and I'd mixed all these things, and boy, was this guy going to be impressed, and so he was sitting there, and Buddy goes, that was kind of like this, you know, in the middle of the room, goes, "Hey, Elizabeth, would you like to go upstairs and see the rats?" You know? And I quickly, we know how to quickly move, I said, "Oh, Buddy, go get Edith. Now, Edith was named for his mother. All the rats were named. That's all the first rats, as long as they could keep having them. Edith was the original alpha mother rat, and she was very tame. And so Buddy brought her down, and she's about this long, you know, and a tail, and he's like, "Well, of course, they'd never seen a rat." I don't think. Usually a black and white rat, and Buddy was sure. He said, "Oh, isn't she precious? She just nuzzles you." And they are sweet. They're sweet when they're talking. I mean, they're not like cats where they scream and yell. They're just gentle lovers. And this was a little gentle kitten, you know, mouse, and she was doing like this. And suddenly, Buddy is holding her. She starts having babies. All of the rats were in some form of gestation. And so they come on little umbilical cords, and they're in little sacks, and he's standing there like this, waving, and they're coming. And he said, stop the conversation. And all he said he could think to do was to take his thumb and shove them back where they were coming from. My most horrible moment. Well, anyway, he wrapped them around her and took them back upstairs and let her finish her job. And the next morning, you know, you just get to the point, I think we go a long way before we get to the point of action. I love our three C's, you know, isn't it? What is it? No, not the three C's, the A. It's awareness, something, and then action. Oh my God, I kind of like the D's, you know, discover and then discard. You know, so I called the zoo and said we had this great gift for the Fort Worth Zoo, and I had these rats. Well, you know what they do with rats for the zoo, and it didn't make any difference to me. I didn't have an emotional involvement with them, and so they said, "Oh, we'll send a man out to pick him up." And I said, "Oh, you don't understand. You're going to need a truck. You're going to need a couple of men with nets." I want every habit trail, everything areas to be removed. You know, I didn't dig up the graves and send the bones out, but it was right about next to that. And they came and they did it. And the children came home, and one more stone in my coffin, you know, was I had destroyed all the rats, you know. The very first litter I flushed down the John, And Rob said, rang and went, she killed Martha and Harry and Joseph. And he had them names, you know. But anyway, that's the rat story. At the end of the drinking, I would get up in the morning. I would wake him up. He would throw up. He'd gotten so like Pavlov's dogs, he'd take one look at me and throw up. You know, I would just wake him up and move back. You know, and so I said, and then I would give him this big lecture on smoking. If he didn't smoke, he wouldn't drink. I'd drag him into the bathroom. I would clean him up. I would put his, take his pajamas off, you know, and then I would put on his socks, and I would put on his underwear, and I would, and he'd sit on the bed. I love you. I love you. You know. So I'd dress him in the clothes I wanted him in, and then I would zip him up, and he would scream, and I didn't care. You know. And he always said I was the only woman he knew that used a zipper as a weapon. But I would, and there was wonder there was any sex left by the time we got to the program. But anyway, then I would go to school, and I would take the kids. Now, we really do have a time thing here. Well, it's upside down, and I don't have my glasses. it's time. Okay. And so I would go to school. I would take all the kids to school. And when I hear people say, don't let your children drive with the alcoholic, I say, don't let them drive with an untreated Al-Anon. I drove, and I loved to drive. I had a little Volkswagen. I would stuff all the children in the car. But before I do that, I'd get Buddy out on the driveway, you know, put him in his car. He would back out. He was in a big 9-passenger station wagon that, you know, it had alcoholic, you know, rash, booted and everything, big old car. And he would back out, and I would have the children that were left, which were just two and myself, stand out on the driveway going, have a great day at work, Daddy. Have a great day at work. Have a good job. We love you. We'll see you after work, Daddy. Now, Daddy didn't have a job. He, you know, I knew he didn't have a job. He knew he didn't have a job. The people next door, the children knew he didn't have a job, but the people next door didn't know he didn't have a job. So we did this little facade, and he had to go to the public library every day from 9 to 5 downtown, where none of our friends went. And I hope in that great facility he would find some tomb of knowledge of something that would give him a job. So, and of course, my mother said he was more trained to do more things than anybody she had ever seen. He had all the diplomas. You know, he was a broker, and he was this, and he was head of a real estate. He was blah, 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 blah. But he didn't make any money, you know. He quit functioning. But anyway, so he'd back out, and I'd go to school. I'd pick your children up, stuff them in this car, and I'd play this game called Motorboat, 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 Go So Slow, Motorboat, Go So Fast, Motorboat, Motorboat, Slow the Gas! And I would roll through the stop signs, and the children would scream, and I would like, isn't that fun, you know? And as we'd approach the elementary school, the children would start saying, the older children would say, jump, jump, because I didn't come to a full stop. I'd get on to high school. If we crossed I-30, the Catholics would cross themselves, you know, hoping we'd get there. I'd jump out of the car, run in front of my class, and I did British poetry, and I loved the romantic poets, and I would walk back and forth, beating my breast, going, what can ail thee, knighted arms, alone and palely loitering, the sedge is withered from the lake, and no birds sing, and I would weep, and a big old football boy, and they said, it just doesn't grab me like it grabs you, Miss Ross. I would race home at second period because I had it off. Everybody else graded papers. I had this agenda of saying that he did not come home. And, of course, he would go many days, yet wobble home. And then I'd run through the thing, throw the door open. What in the hell are you doing? He'd have a vodka bottle. He'd be back in clean pajamas. We'd go through the whole thing, zip up, scream, laugh, throw him in the car. Then I'd follow him to make sure he went where he was supposed to go. And then I started testing him, and I would hang back about 2 blocks to see if he minded. It was very important to me. Winnie Eddy from California said, I didn't care if they sobered up, they just learned to mind, and that was where I was. And so I would follow him, and I would test him, and he'd look around, and he couldn't see me, and he'd turn into this Andy Capp's bar, which was about 4 blocks from our house. When I saw him turning toward the bar, I would floorboard the Volkswagen. I would roar and I would kiss him like that, just as hard as I could. His head would do like this, you know. And I would lean out of the thing and I would go, you get to the public library, like that. this was all about 4 blocks from my home, and the group he went into was about 5 blocks from home. And when we came in, every person in the Monticello Rivercrest area thought I was the alcoholic. None of them thought Buddy Ross was the alcoholic. You don't mean that sweet Buddy Ross was the alcoholic. I have seen, did you know she had 157 rats up there? I have seen. So, and then I'd come home in the afternoon, and I would fix his drink, you know, at my bar, and he would have one drink. I always fix him with, I like things that tasted good, you know, with milk and sugar and so fun things, whatever page we were on. And I'd have my little hors d'oeuvres with the chickens, they could do that. And I'd run the children off, you know, go to your room, study. Go to your room, bye, you know, go to your room, study. And I'd lock the door. There was a door between where the bedrooms were downstairs and where we were. And then we would have our cocktail hour, because everybody needs a cocktail hour, and you can have 2 drinks at your cocktail hour. So he would have a drink, and then he would pass out. And I would lift him up like this and say, you can have another drink. And he'd go, oh, okay, you know. And by now, the children would be beating on the door, we need dinner, let us out, you know. And I'd unlock the door, and the two would come running in. And we ate really fast, you know, because the minute I watched Buddy the whole time, the minute he started going, dinner was over. And sometimes they hadn't had the main stuff, and I'd just grab all the food, and I'd run in, and they'd be trying to grab the piece of chicken or something. I'd run and I'd say, everybody to your room to study, everybody to your room to study. And I'd run in the kitchen, and I'd be scraping the plates and throwing them like this, okay? And then I'd be running back across again, because and unbuttoning my towel, because I had to get to bed fast for sex. I don't know about you all, I had to get to bed really fast for sex. And so I would go running in the bedroom, you know, and he would be passed out, and I would lift him up like this and say, do you want sex? And he'd go, no! Throw up! Yeah. We were a dysfunctional family. And what happened was, he had his moment of clarity that the AAs talk about so much, and is so beautiful, and is God working in their life. I always want to kind of throw up when I first heard that, because we had a moment of clarity that lasted 27 years. I mean, my moment of clarity went on and on. But he got his, and he was in a bar, and he said it was like a voice said to him, if you don't quit drinking, you're going to lose your wife and your family and your life. And he turned to the bartender and said, I'm going to quit drinking. Now, he was now drinking over a bottle a day. I mean, a bottle in the floor, a bottle and a half, I'm not real sure. But way over a bottle. He was a every other hour drinker, night and day. He was that kind of drinker. And to me, they're really hard, because he didn't dance on the tables. He didn't ever even had a parking ticket, much less a moving. I had many moving valets. Cannot tell you how many. I wrecked cars. I would back out of my driveway. I'd look, and nobody would be there, and I'd shoot out of the driveway and wreck your car. And you just gotten out of your little picnic basket to take your children on something, and I would have destroyed your car, and I'd say, I have insurance to my husband, and I'd drive them off, you know, laughing. You know, wonderful brother day, you know, God's world. And, but anyway, so he calls the doctor, tells him, the doctor says, I'm gonna put you in the hospital and sober you up. This was 76. There were only two treatment centers in the state of Texas, and of course he's not an alcoholic, you see. And he's told me, I'd catch him drinking, I'd say in the middle of the night, I'd say, what are you doing? I didn't say it quite like that. What in the hell do you think you're doing? And he would go, I'm a hopeless alcoholic, I'm trying to have a drink. And I would scream, you are not an alcoholic, I never want to hear that word in this household. The children will hear you, because the children were hearing everything, mainly me. So anyway, he put him in the hospital, and then the doctor called me at school and said, Buddy tells me he's a hopeless alcoholic, I put him in the hospital, I'm going to dry him out for two or three days. And Buddy said to him these great words, if you're going to have a good life, you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, oh, no trouble with Alcoholics Anonymous. He drifted by there one time and asked how not to drink till 5 o'clock. You can't drink like a lady. He came in and said, I'd like to learn how not to drink till 5 o'clock. And they said, we don't have an 18-hour program. And he went to a couple of meetings and left. So, but it was just a kind of a little something that happened with him. But he went, oh, I love it. I have a big book. Oh, I love it. Oh, my gosh. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. So, but they called me. I jumped in the car. I had no recovery. of course. And I foreboarded that Volkswagen. I was furious at that doctor. He had bought that story. And all Buddy wanted was just to get away from me, have meals on time, lay up in clean sheets, run up a hospital bill. So I got in that car and I foreboarded. I got there. I ran up the stairs. And he had told the doctor, you can't put me on an alcoholic floor. Beverly won't let me stay. And he was right. And so they put him on a chest surgery floor over past the man who had had chest surgery. And I run, throw the door open, and I scream, what in the hell do you think you are doing here? And this man who's had chest surgery, and Buddy pulls the sheet and says, Beverly Hope is alcoholic, I'm trying to get smarter. And I go, you are not an alcoholic. Somebody is going to come down this hall and see you don't have any kind of scar and you don't have any pubes like that, man. And you're not going, well, the man is now going, back for the cardiac arrest. Well, anyway, needless to say, he never, ever, from the moment he sat down on that bed, he said he never wanted to drink again. God in removed totally the compulsion to drink from him. And I really believe totally that is true because he said it through his entire life. And it was like the thing that had been with him for so long was gone. And, but they had me, see. And I was, you know, I was happy he wasn't drinking. I thought it was kind of, you know, like he joined the shrine or something. I couldn't quite figure it out, but it had nothing to do with me. And I very quickly told him, now, Buddy, if there is something down there called alcoholics, I am not interested in being a member. I said, I have done Rotary Ann, and I have done this, and early on in his career, they had, when he was really early, about 28 or 9, some people had come to him to see, his brother was a state senator from there, brother-in-law, asked if, thought about running him for mayor. Thank God that stuff was removed. But anyway, so I had done a lot of stuff, and I said, I am just not interested in that. I don't want to be an alcoholic. So he said, okay, and they told him, don't ask her to come. Now, they lived in our neighborhood. I don't think they wanted me, to tell you the truth. But they said, don't ask her to come. And so he had a year of recovery when I got here. And the thing that happened was he started getting better, and he became very, to me, very spiritual because he was reading the big book and the big book and this book and that book, and he had quiet time, and he was changing. And if you're in here and you think, how unfair, I'm having to go to this program, they are sick as hell like I was, I want to tell you it's impacting them because it started impacting me. The first thing they told him was, get a key to the house. I didn't trust him with a key. I mean, he'd knock on the door, and I'd say, who is it? And he'd say, it's me. And I'd say, have you had anything to drink today? And he would go, no. And I believed him every time. And opened the door and let him in. So, anyway, he didn't ask me. But finally, one day, he was going to a meeting on Sunday. I had been head of the Episcopal Women in the Fort Worth Dallas Diocese. People were asking at church where he was because he had been a lay reader. And I said, you've got to go to church with me. He said, Beverly, I have found the God of my understanding at Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am going to the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I said, that's it. You have had it. And I grabbed a file notebook, which I have many of, and a pen, and I said, I am going to that meeting this morning, and I am going to look every one of those people in the face, because when people would come to call on him, I would look like this and walk out. I thought anonymity was me not looking at you. So I had this big deal, and they thought it was very weird, you know, because if somebody came from AA to see him, I would run like this, so I didn't embarrass you, because it must be a terribly embarrassing thing to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. And so... so anyway, I told him I'm going to look in every one of their faces, and not only that, I'm going to put their name in this file notebook, and I'm going to tell everyone in Fort Worth that they are a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, that's how darling I was that morning. And would you believe, I wouldn't do this. I just have to tell you, I don't have the recovery today to do this. To take somebody like that to my Al-Anon meeting scares me to death. Oh, my God. It's like watching a movie. It's like watching Steve Martin or something, or somebody weird out there, and it was me. You know, I just can't believe it. But anyway, so I took my notebook, and he said, all right. And he took me. It was an open meeting at the Harbor Group, and it was in the fall of 76. And I went with my book, and I walked through that Sunday morning, and I found exactly what I found this Sunday morning in these rooms. And it was like this place that was like heaven on earth. I had never seen love like that. People hugging, people laughing, you know, like you do, laughing.
people, I felt the love. I felt the hope. I felt the circle. And it was a God moment. And I dropped that notebook, and the most beautiful, how many people in here are women in Alcoholics Anonymous? Well, you are my angel, because I dropped that notebook, and I grabbed those women, and I said, I want to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was crying. And they said, and I hope the integrity of Alcoholics Anonymous is the same all over as it was in Texas in 1976, because they said to me, how much do you drink? And I said, I drink. And I had now read the big book and corrected all of it, every line, every page, you know. And I know you've heard this. It's not supposed to be if you want what we've got. Such terrible English. It's supposed to be if you want what we have, you know. And I'd gone through and that, you know. And so I turned to them and I said, you can't keep me out, because I have a sincere desire to stop drinking, and that's the only requirement for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to tell you, those Texas women kept me out. They turned to me and they said, you need to be with them. And I thought, I looked kind of over, and oh my God, it was the Alcoholettes. I knew it. I just knew it. They kind of clustered over there. They weren't near as cute as the AA women. I'm telling you, they were dooted up, they had cute clothes, and they were just darling. These people look like me, you know. Oh, God. You know, I said, oh, no. So I went to open meetings every day. And those alcoholic women, who kept me literally out of the room, gave me a big book, had me go through it. Every place it said alcoholic, put alcohol, put control, and every place it said alcoholic, put Beverly. And it fit me perfectly. Absolutely, 100%. Because I would have died. I had horrible health problems when I got here. I won't even deal with that, but this terrible back, been in and out of the hospital, blah, blah, blah. All tension. I mean, I know it was, but I know I would have died. I know I would have. And maybe after or before I went completely crazy and they had to lock me up, it would be one or the other. But anyway, so the way I got to the program was Buddy started taping conferences. And I didn't like that. I mean, that was, what a bizarre thing to start doing. You need to go back and be a broker, you know. And so, has a lot better sound to it. Excuse me, Glenn. but he did both for a while. And he said, and we had, my dad was in our business, and so we had some oil stuff coming in. Not a lot, but a little. And so he started taking conferences, and I went with him, and I went to the first conference, and I've forgotten your name. You're so quiet. What is your name? Al. Al is in the God seat, because I was sitting on the aisle in the second row at my first. I didn't know it was now my meeting. I was just crazy. I was just going to all the meetings, eating the food, laughing, woo, hugging all that, avoiding the alcoholic. And so I go into, it was in Longview, Texas, big conference, about 1,200 people. And so I'm sitting in that chair, and Gracie A. from Dallas, Texas, who I can say his name, David Aronofsky, who was a trustee for AA's wife, was speaking. We are not the same at all. She chased him around with a butcher knife. I chased mine with a car. Oh, my God, I forgot to tell you how good that feels. When you hit that car, the rush that goes through is just wonderful, wonderful. And they told me in Al-Anon I couldn't do that anymore. It was a real downer. Because I'll tell you, people mind if they think you're going to take a car and hit them. They really try to mind. But anyway, I heard her, and I cried, tears started going down my cheeks, and if they had rolled a bathtub out and said, now we're going to come up and dunk you and into Al-Anon, if you're going to slit your wrist and let you bleed with us, I would have done it. Because I joined Al-Anon in that seat, and on April the 2nd, it will be 24 years. And I started working the steps, and in Texas, we make every Al-Anon buy the big book and read it. And I read the big book, and I read, thank you. I don't know how anybody understands about alcoholism if they don't read the big book. But anyway, we're not here to preach. Texas was the last state that gave that up. I mean, it was, you know, but anyway, we voted to the end to keep it. But anyway, I started reading the literature, and we have incredible Al-Anon literature. I mean, it was for me. I mean, Al-Anon literature saved my life. My sponsor made me read tape that July the 1st and the ODAT, One Day at a Time, for 6 months. And I can tell you, it says, the man that I married is not to be the source of my happiness or my sorrow. My life is my life to live alone, and his is his. We each follow our lonely path, etc. You don't think that didn't help me when my husband that I adored died? I mean, that is so ingrained in me, I can't tell you. Also, though, ingrained in me are the promises. And when Betty died, he asked that the promises be, I mean, when he didn't know he was going to die, but I mean, we'd written out a few little things, and years ago he'd written something, and it was very incomplete down at the funeral home, and they pulled it up, and it said he wanted the promises on the front of the funeral thing, you know, when you go to the funeral. And they put them in the shape of a cross, and they call it the Ross Cross. Precious. Anyway, so we started our journey, and I'll make the journey fast, I did the steps, and I found two wonderful things with the steps. In Texas, we do the steps all the time. We have step meetings, you know, steps. You can sit in the garage and never become a car. You can sit in Al-Anon meetings and never become an Al-Anon if you don't get a sponsor. Work the steps. Go things. And to me, the reason I love this and I love that chair is that, to me, conventions are frosting on the cake. And there's no convention. There's nothing I won't do to pay back what happened to me in that convention. But anyway, I found that I didn't handle suicide well, and in doing my inventory, I realized my mother-in-law, that I adored more than anybody in the world, she was an untreated Al-Anon. Both of her children were alcoholic, and she was my best friend. I mean to tell you, I loved her. Oh my gosh, I can just see her today. She was the cutest thing. She's just like my husband. She was adorable. And one day, this woman I loved so much took a knife and cut her throat. And it was years into the program that I could tell that from the podium. You know, it was just so awful. And we got there before anything. And, I mean, I don't think the ambulance was there. Her daughter was at her daughter's home. And so we got there, and I took Buddy's hand, and I said, it's not your fault. It is not your fault, over and over. Now, I'll tell you whose fault I thought it was. I thought it was mine, because I wasn't drinking. She had said, so she was 82, and she was, it was just, I don't even want to go into it. It was so horrible. But what Al-Anon did, and what the steps did, and what the reading did, and what my sponsors and my friends and the people I sponsored did for me, was today, and since then, I worked on a hotline for suicide. And in the big book it says, your dark past can be your greatest asset. And that came true for me. Because I have had three people I sponsored who I loved a lot, whose sons committed suicide. And I could go to, one was in Kansas, Susan and Don P. And one was in Hobbs, New Mexico, and one was in Fort Worth. And I can be right there with them and say, it's not your fault, and really know how they feel, because we too tend to take a lot of blame if there's a suicide. But anyway, Al-Anon got me through that. And today I can see the color red. I can wear the color red. For a year I couldn't do that because of the blood. I see her with joy. I see her in God's arms. I know that she knows that she's with my precious husband, if nothing else. And I know that she knows we've had recovery, and I know that she's joyous for us, and I really feel it. And to the depth of my being, I've lost my mother that I adored. My mother and daddy lived three blocks from us. I saw them every day but Tuesday. I set up a little boundary. I'm not going to go on Tuesday. They were older. I absolutely adored them. And my mother dropped dead on Easter Day. I went by to pick her up. Now, she'd swim laps. I mean, she was very active, 90 years old. I went to pick her up for church, and she had dropped dead. And Al-Anon took me through that. I mean, it was wonderful. And I'd worship my daddy. I was my daddy's little girl. I mean, I just loved him to death. And he died at 92, but after a very active life. And I'm very grateful. I'm grateful my mother dropped dead. What a great way to go. You know, it's marvelous. The last thing I have to share with you is this marriage and this man that I love so much. About 2 years in, I said, we were talking about something, and I had prayed in my morning, and I do meditate and pray every morning. I set my alarm early, and I read my books, and I don't have to work today. I retired from teaching many years ago, and I have about 2 hours. I said, I know that's a lot of time, but I will tell you, I was really sick, and I really loved my quiet time. and I need it. And so, and I've learned to not pray for things. I just actually do the third step prayer, and I pray that, you know, God will put in my path the people I need and take the people I love and bless them, and I want everything for them, and my enemies are people I'm resentful of that I want for myself. And so, but anyway, I knew something was wrong with my marriage, and I thought, I want to be the best wife I can be, God, and so you let me know and what I can do. And so 3 days later, my husband told me he didn't love me, didn't hate me. He just didn't have any feeling for me at all. Today, I know his feelings were dead. But I immediately went, well, I am not living with anybody that doesn't love me. And I had learned enough in Al-Anon. If I had said to him, he would say from the podium, if Beverly had said, what can I do? I will do anything to make this marriage work. She would have been dead meat, because he would have changed the rules over and over for what was good for him. So what we did, he said, I want to rebuild our marriage with the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. And so we took them and we rewrote them, and we put them in our lives like the greatest good for the greatest number. They are an incredible tool in your personal relationships. Principles before personalities. That saved us a million times, because we both had big personalities. His was bigger than mine, so you can imagine what we were like. It was an exciting household. But anyway, he was a lot sweeter than I was personality. But we took them. I'm pointing to them, and I don't even see them. They were up here someplace. Oh, they're over there. Yeah. Anyway, the seventh one I'll just say two words about, and that is, it said, the seventh tradition is that we are self-supporting through our own efforts. And so we had to look at everyone with our, we went through it and we had our sponsors, and we went through it. And when we got to that one, we wrote it, we were not self-supporting. We didn't ever ask for money, but I had a father that had money, and so they would give us two cars, or they would give, pay off our house payment for a year, which was good because it was 3 months in a year when we got the program. Or they pay, very important, they pay the country club bill. This is really important, you know, or whatever. And we'd have the water cut off, but we'd still belong to the country club. You know, there's a lot of not good priorities here. But anyway, so we had to become self-supporting. And because Daddy was the final answer, you know, there was a safety net there. And so we went to my parents, and we rehearsed with our sponsors, and we went and we said, we can no longer take gifts like that. We cannot do that. We can't take cars. We can't take this. We can't. And I know it was devastating. It was shocking. They were probably thrilled. I don't really know. But they kind of went, you know. And it was going great until my husband panicked and went, no, we're not talking inheritance here. Kind of ruined this beautiful kind of God-like thing. We'd gotten on our knees and prayed we'd have the courage to do it. And how God worked with that was Buddy Ross became successful. Buddy Ross became a whole person. Buddy became the head of the household instead of Daddy, you know. So, I don't know that I was your church. But I have loved all of you, and you have been wonderful to me. And it is a circle of hope. He died on October the 8th. He wasn't supposed to die. He hadn't had cancer since May. He'd had an MRI on Wednesday. His heart was bothering him a little bit, and they said, don't wait if anything like that happens. Call, you know, the 911. And I did. And he was so funny. He took some oxygen mask off and said, to the, you know, he's lying there. And his heart has stopped by now, but we're taking him to the hospital. And he said, you know, we've always wanted to have all of you to the house, but not this way. You know, just oxygen mask back on. I mean, he's so cute. And so, and we laughed, and he went out and got to the hospital. He hadn't had a heart attack. They said, oh, we'll let him go home. I'm sure he's fine. He hadn't had cancer since May, and, you know, things look good. And our doctor, who's been in the program, and I sponsored his wife, came to the hospital at 11:30, and he said, you know, I'd like to keep him for observation. And that was God. Because he died in the hospital of a massive heart attack. And he would have died in my arms at home. And I don't think I could have handled that. I would have had to move. I couldn't, because I absolutely adore my husband to this moment. And it was, you know, we were, God put us together in a weird way. And I am so grateful. I am so grateful for 25 years of his recovery and 24 years of mine. And 24 years of an incredible marriage that you all gave. Incredible. We just, the last day we lived, we had sex. You know, had to end on that. So, how about that? And no Viagra. I mean, he was a fun man. And And in closing, the last sentence I'll say truly is that I read when I was in speaking someplace like New Mexico, and they said, I opened a prayer book because I've got the clock where I speak, and it was Thomas Aquinas, and it said, when we reach the day of judgment, we'll never be asked how well we spoke, but how well we lived. And you all really have taught me how to live. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being so strong and being here.